sure that this was the answer, self-knowledge. But it wasn't. He kept drinking anyway. What eventually did save Wilson was the arrival of an old friend named Ebby, whose candor about his own drinking and his newfound spirituality opened Wilson to the possibility of belief. At first, Wilson wasn't convinced. Let him rant, he thought. My gin would last longer than his preaching. But something shifted during their talk, and after it was done, Wilson went to the hospital to be separated from alcohol for the last time. As he wrote in the big book, I have not had a drink since. This switch to present perfect, I have not had, is how his readers know that this time was different from all the other times he stopped. Those times were all doomed to the past tense, the endless cycle. I still thought I could control the situation. There were periods of sobriety. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. I had written lots of sweet promises. In no time, I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. I told myself I would manage better next time. At the hospital where he went to dry out, Wilson had a moment of intense connection with God. I felt lifted up, as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. But the big book doesn't frame Wilson's moment of sublimity as the turning point in his sobriety, this visionary moment of being blown through by the mountain wind. It frames his turning point as the conversation with Ebby, when he saw eye to eye with a friend at his kitchen table. That's the moral of the story. This communion is what made the mountain wind possible. AA itself began not when Wilson got sober, but when he helped another man get sober, an Akron doctor named Dr. Bob, who would become famous too as the stranger Wilson saved, the first of many. Early in my sobriety, I met a stranger I wanted to save. Dave and I had a few people over one night, and I was trying hard to be a good host, unloading pink boxes from work full of jam-oozing scones and caramel cinnamon buns that had been gooey at breakfast, but were harder now, stale cardboard approximations of their morning selves. When I came back from the kitchen with the pastries arranged on plates, I found a girl in a gold lycra bodysuit holding court in our living room. Everyone assumed someone else knew her, but no one did. We were all getting to know her, or at least we were learning that she was looking for this party where her friend was supposed to be. She was very drunk. She just wandered through our unlocked front door and come upstairs. She'd heard voices and thought perhaps this was the party she'd been looking for. Her lycra bodysuit was truly astonishing. We're playing a board game, someone explained to her, but she wasn't interested in our board game. She was interested in her friend's party. Her face was glazed, her eyes rolling around like marbles. I offered to drive her home, already imagining how it would play out. We'd have a conversation in the car about drinking, where it had gotten her, where it had gotten me. Maybe I'd take her to the Sunday night meeting, or maybe I'd just tell the story of her there. It would be my first act of sober heroism. I went to the bedroom to get my keys. But when I came back, she was gone. She'd just wandered off, the others said, just like she'd wandered in. I got in my car anyway and cruised the dark streets looking for her shiny gold suit shambling through the shadows. But I never found her. Every meeting was a chorus. You got to know the regulars. A man named Mitch remembered waking up one morning, after a bender, in a car that wasn't his, in the middle of a field, to see a cow sticking her nose through the open window. A woman named Gloria described taking long naps when her daughter was young, drinking alone in her bedroom and answering, groggy and irritated, whenever her daughter knocked on the door. A man named Carl remembered drinking thermos after thermos of instant coffee, compulsively, into jittery oblivion, as a boy in elementary school. A man named Keith, in his polyester tracksuit, was usually quiet, but one day he said simply, "When I drink, hope dies in me." A man named Felix, an aging heroin addict in a red beanie, said he loved being hungry. It was his body telling him it wanted to live. A woman named Dana had half her hair shaved, with purple streaks in what was left. She rarely smiled those first few months after she got off heroin. The way she glared at me sometimes, I was sure she found me tiresome and long-winded. But one day she laughed so hard at something I shared about tuning the car radio to NPR before turning off the ignition, so that when Dave started the car, he would think I'd been listening to NPR, because it seemed like I should listen to NPR, rather than the ridiculous pop music I played instead. It was a trivial thing, but also not. It was about lying to give the world what we wanted it to see. "That's me," Dana said. "That's totally me." When I started giving her rides to meetings, we never played NPR. After a few months clean, she really bloomed. You could see it in her eyes and body, how tightly she hugged other women. One morning, I picked her up during a huge snowstorm, with the roads nearly empty. My car was shit in the snow. I blasted the heat and clenched the wheel. We fishtailed all the way but made the meeting. We had a time now, the two of us. We had a story. That day we drove through the snow. That day we weren't sure we'd make it, but then we did. Bill Wilson told the story of his sobriety different ways, depending on where he was telling it, or to whom. While the Big Book version of his story featured his kitchen table conversation with Ebby as an unequivocal epiphany, my ideas about miracles were drastically revised right then. His autobiography confessed a few more binges after this visit. It was only after the wind on the mountain, he said, that he stayed sober for good. The disjunction between these two versions wasn't a question of vanity or authenticity so much as pragmatism. For the Big Book, Wilson wanted to stress the importance of what AA offered, which was identification and fellowship, rather than pinning sobriety on the type of intense spiritual experience that some people might never have. He didn't alter his story out of self-concern, but from a nearly opposite impulse. He understood his own life as a public tool rather than a private artifact. Wilson's story was a complicated tool because it created certain pressures of its own. What about the reader who didn't stay sober for good after his first conversation with a sober friend? Perhaps that reader relapsed 6 more times, called his sober friend drunk, and said, "Sorry that I can't stay sober like that guy in the Big Book." That's why Wilson wanted to put out a book that reflected the structure of a meeting, that held the stories of others, not just his own. He gave the Big Book a fitting subtitle: The Story of How Many Thousands of Men and Women Have Recovered from Alcoholism. The single story of the whole book held the plural population of its many tales. Wilson didn't want his story to become binding archetype or narrative legislation. You must be sober like this. He wanted to make room for everyone who hadn't found great wins on mountaintops or deliverance in a single conversation. He wanted to play the foundations of this movement down because he thought it worked better without too much sanction from the top. Wilson didn't want to become a saint, but he found himself the number one man in a movement he'd sculpted to resist the whole notion of being number one anything. At an AA conference in 1958, he told the crowd, "I am like you. I, too, am fallible." He wrote a letter to an AA member named Barbara explaining that a perch had been constructed for him that no human man could possibly occupy. That was part of why he hated the idea of writing an autobiography, the fear that it would elevate his perch even further. "Of course, I have always been intensely averse to anything autobiographical being done in print," he wrote in the foreword to an autobiography that was eventually published after his death. Titled Bill W., My First 40 Years, it was actually a series of transcribed conversations Wilson had conducted with a fellow sober friend named Ed Bierstadt in 1954. The book's structure replaced the standard one-man show of memoir with the conversation of fellowship. The book framed itself as an inoculation, an attempt to preempt the hagiographies that might follow. And during its conversations, Wilson is constantly reckoning with the question of his own ego. He's worried about the ways that telling his story might threaten to inflate it, that he might take too much pride in his old sins or his new redemption. Ed and I just had a good laugh about the Wall Street days of the last record, he confesses at one point. It is all too clear that I reverted to type. The whole tone of the thing sounds like I was in a bar room, pounding on the bar, talking big deals, financial omnipotence, and power. It's a narrative relapse. For a moment, Wilson's voice loses its sobriety and reverts to drunken self-aggrandizement, bragging about his financial escapades. For a moment, self-exposure lapses into its dark alter ego, self-promotion. This is an occupational hazard when it comes to conversation narratives. What if your pleasure in telling stories about the old prodigal days betrays that part of you still wants to return to them? But Wilson confesses it, the slip, the creep of pride. And by confessing that his old drunk ego has momentarily hijacked the story, he trusts he can reclaim it. One of the first major media features about AA, Jack Alexander's 1941 article for the Saturday Evening Post, was skeptical about the dramatic storytelling habits of its members. They behaved like a bunch of actors sent out by some Broadway casting agency, Alexander wrote, but he happily reproduced a catalog of their tales. They tell of the 8-ounce bottles of gin hidden behind pictures and in caches from cellar to attic, of spending whole days in motion picture houses to stave off the temptation to drink, of sneaking out of the office for quickies during the day. They talk of losing jobs and stealing money from their wives' purses, of putting pepper into whiskey to give it a tang, of tippling on bitters and sedative tablets, or on mouthwash or hair tonic, of getting into the habit of camping outside the neighborhood tavern 10 minutes before opening time. They describe a hand so jittery that it could not lift a pony to the lips without spilling the contents. Drinking liquor from a beer stein because it can be steadied with two hands, although at the risk of chipping a front tooth. Tying an end of a towel about a glass, looping the towel around the back of the neck, and drawing the free end with the other hand, pulley fashion, to advance the glass to the mouth. Hands so shaky they feel as if they were about to snap off and fly into space, sitting on hands for hours to keep them from doing this. What Alexander begins to realize, or at least frames as a realization for his article, is that these sober men aren't telling their stories as performance pieces, to play the parts of feckless dilettantes or sanctimonious altruists. They're offering their stories as cures, for other people and for themselves. Of course, it's not an either-or. Someone can be trying to seduce a crowd and save their lives, can crave glory and earnest utility at once. Alexander insists that AA members are like diabetics, with drunk saving as their insulin. He doesn't build them up as selfless saints, but as people whose self-preservation involves making themselves useful. They don't just tell their stories as cocktail party anecdotes, see what I've lived, or wound badges, see what I've suffered, but so they can reach people who need them. Take Sarah Martin, who jumped or fell out of a window drunk, landed face first on the pavement, and suffered through 6 months of dental work and plastic surgery. Now she spends many of her nights, Alexander observes, sitting on hysterical women drinkers to prevent them from diving out of windows. Sarah talks about jumping out of a window not because it distinguishes her, but because it doesn't. Alexander's article was written with Bill Wilson's help, and it was published with his endorsement and his gratitude. For many a day, Wilson wrote to Alexander, you will be the toast of AA. In Coca-Cola, of course. In the first 12 days after the article was published, AA heard from nearly 1,000 alcoholics who wanted help. By the end of 1941, the program had more than 8,000 members. By 1950, it had 100,000. By 2015, it had more than 2 million. What does the concept of recovery mean? It can mean healing, repair, relocation, reclamation, or recuperation. French philosopher Catherine Malabou proposes three different visions of recovery, attaching each one to an animal: the phoenix, the spider, and the salamander. The phoenix represents a version of recovery in which the wound is utterly erased, an annulment of the defect, the mark, the lesion. Just as the phoenix rises unscathed from the ashes, perfectly unblemished, precisely as it was before. It's like skin healing without a scar. And it's something close to the psychic opposite of AA, in which wounds are not forgotten, but fundamental. Their narration, the glue binding every Sarah Martin and her flock of newcomers. AA lives somewhere between Malibu's other creatures. The spider offers a model of recovery that involves something like an endless accumulation of scars spun into a web. Like a text, covered with marks, nicks, scratches, that refuses the possibility of taking on a new skin without blemishes. While the salamander, Malibu's third recovery mascot, grows a new limb that is neither scarred nor identical to the one it had before. This new limb is not the spider's endless web of scars, but it's not a phoenix-style resurrection either, recovery bringing back an unchanged version of the former self, because the salamander's new limb has a different size, shape, and weight. There is no scar, but there is a difference, Malibu writes. The difference is neither a form of higher life nor a monstrous gap. AA's vision of regeneration proposes a sober identity that is neither a replica of the prior self, with the drinking excised like a tumor, nor a version of this self covered with calluses and scars, but a new organ entirely. The transformation is neither holy nor grievous. It's just a strategy of survival. The program's 12 steps have become famous, reaching from surrender to confession, admitting that your life has become unmanageable in the first step, surrendering to a higher power in the third, sharing an inventory of your resentments and character defects in the fifth, making amends to those you've harmed in the ninth, and reaching out to help others in the 12th. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics. In this way, in this ongoingness, the steps are never done. When I first heard the phrase witness authority, it was like hearing someone say dihydrogen monoxide and then thinking, of course, water. Dr. Meg Chisholm, a psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins, was telling me she recommends AA to patients mainly for its social infrastructure and for this witness authority, meaning the way other AA members offer, by sharing their experiences, a lived authority distinct from her own. So that's what you call it, I thought. I'd already been living on it for years. Bug getting me right that first night, or Dana saying, that's me, as if her whole life had been spent listening to the wrong radio station. Dr. Kaplan told me that his patients often say to him, you'd be doing heroin too, doctor. You don't know what it means to walk a mile in my shoes. He works with Baltimore addicts whose lives often differ sharply from his own, and part of what these patients find in recovery is recognition. Both Dr. Kaplan and Dr. Chisholm told me that 12-step recovery can be a delivery mechanism for effective behavioral treatments, like positive reinforcement and peer support, but it has no monopoly on them. It teaches coping strategies, facilitates community, and rewards abstinence with poker chips and birthday cake, with a room of people clapping for your 90th day, your first year, your 30th. Meetings are particularly useful for people who need to hear themselves confessing, Dr. Kaplan said. When I heard the sinuous, glimmering energy of recovery offered back to me in these clinical phrases, contingency management and community reinforcement, I got a sense of deja vu. It wasn't unlike hearing about the dopamine transport blockage responsible for the billowing sale of my cocai. Nothing was falsified or cheapened, only translated and specified, charted like a ship's voyage on a different type of map. When Dr. Chisholm told me that she sometimes attaches a warning when she encourages certain patients to seek out AA, it didn't surprise me. You're really smart, she tells them. That might work against you. The idea of being too smart for AA immediately resonated with a part of me that sometimes found its truisms too reductive or its narratives too simple. But I was also aware that being too smart for AA could become its own siren call to the ego, considering yourself the exception to the common story, exempt from every aphorism, with a consciousness too complicated to have much in common with anyone else. I was even aware that my rejection of that ego trip was, in its way, also a revision of it. I was proud that I didn't feel too smart for AA, as if I deserved a gold star for resisting that arrogance. In the early days of his sobriety, Charles Jackson dismissed AA wholeheartedly, calling it a group for simple souls and weaklings founded on a bunch of mystical blah blah. He got angry when a local bookseller, a bloody boor, pushed AA on him too forcefully. You SOB, Jackson thought. If you don't think I know what I'm doing by now, after 8 years of sobriety on my own, then you don't know very much. It's not surprising that The Lost Weekend, written in the thick of Jackson's AA skepticism, didn't present an optimistic portrait of fellowship-based recovery. In a 1943 letter to his publisher, a year before the book came out, Jackson describes the novel's relationship to the possibility of a solution. It is offered, so to speak, and then taken away, not used. From a recovery standpoint, the problem with Jackson's anti-hero, Don Burnham, isn't simply that Don can't stop drinking. It's that he keeps telling the wrong type of story. He's interested in anecdotal humor rather than painful self-exposure. After his failed attempt to pawn his typewriter, for instance, as he staggers 100 blocks along 3rd Avenue, Don's first impulse is to redeem the experience by transforming it into anecdote. He imagines his audience would only want to laugh. They wouldn't care to learn or hear of the real, the uncomfortable, the cruel and painful details behind the joke. If recovery is premised on the call to share the cruel and painful details of one's experience, then Drunk Don reveals himself as a teller of anti-AA stories, stories that value anecdotal entertainment above the exposure of authentic difficulty. 15 years after he published the novel, Jackson stood in front of an AA meeting in Cleveland and tried to tell a different type of story. By saying he was tired of being his own hero, and by telling a room full of strangers that his definitive portrait hadn't done him any good, Jackson was, of course, participating in the act of storytelling even as he questioned it. But storytelling in a recovery fellowship wasn't the same mode of storytelling as his best-selling novel. It was supposed to be less invested in himself and more invested in others. I couldn't get outside myself, he told the group. I think this is the thing that plagues the alcoholic so much. I was too self-absorbed, too self-infatuated, and I drank. By the time he addressed this AA group in 1959, Jackson had come a long way from his early dismissals. I tell you, boy, he wrote one friend, there is much, much more to AA than mere sobriety. There is happiness and a whole new way of life. Jackson first started going to meetings in the mid-40s, not as a member but as a speaker, somewhat grudgingly, at the behest of his publisher, to publicize The Lost Weekend. But at a Hartford AA chapter, he couldn't help trying to win over a crowd of 600 by admitting that AA fellowship might have been just what Don Burnham needed. It wasn't until Jackson bottomed out in 1953, one of many bottoms, that he finally wanted to join. These people knew about me, he said. These people had been where I had been and had something I didn't have, and I wanted it. This was during a stint at the Saul Clinic, an alcoholic ward in Philadelphia run by a doctor who, years earlier, had written Jackson a personal letter imploring him to write a sequel describing Don's recovery. I am thinking solely of the responsibility that is yours and the great good that you can do, Dr. Saul had written, as every alcoholic, his friends, and his family await the sequel to The Lost Weekend. But by the time Jackson arrived at the Saul Clinic, 9 years later, The irony was palpable. Jackson was asking for help getting better from the doctor who had wanted him to help others get better by writing the story of how he'd already done it himself. At first, Jackson was worried he wouldn't be among intellectual equals in AA, but as he spent more time in meetings, he grew less convinced that intellectual kinship was what mattered most. When he called one AA chapter in Montpelier, Vermont, for more information, they asked if he wanted to come join them as a speaker, but he said he'd rather just show up and listen. Through his sponsor, he grew increasingly enamored with a quote from G.K. Chesterton, "How much larger your life would be if yourself could become smaller in it. You would find yourself under a freer sky, in a street full of splendid strangers." Jackson had found a crew of splendid strangers, or splendid enough, sitting on folding chairs in church basements all over New England, and swapping stories, trading drunken abandon for another kind of liberty. One evening in the dead of winter, I went to a sober ladies' night in a big house in the middle of an Iowa subdivision. The house belonged to a woman named Nell, and it was immaculate, with a brown leather living room set and a white shag rug. It was eerie, the clean and polish of everything, the hanging metal saucepans gleaming in their dangling rows. It seemed lonely. From her shares and meetings, I knew that Nell's husband was struggling with her relapses. We were having game night. Someone had brought balderdash. Someone had brought apples to apples, where one player dealt a card with an adjective: expensive, useful, rich, and everyone else had to play a noun from the cards in her hand. Switzerland, igloo, bank robber. A woman named Lori had made banana muffins, still steaming in their basket, wrapped in cloth. A woman named Ginger brought turkey pot pie, and Val brought something called chicken surprise, made of 5 different kinds of beige. Cream of this, cream of that, milk and grated cheese and mayonnaise. I could remember sweating straight rum onto my sheets, kissing a man at dawn with coke crackling through my veins, getting woozy on a lawn full of fireflies. That was living. I'd been so sure of it. This night was several kinds of casserole. I'd brought cookies from the bakery. Wherever I went, I brought cookies from the bakery, in a pink box speckled with tiny archipelagos of grease. Nell took them from me, excited, and I felt like a child, so pleased by her pleasure, by the primal buzz of food passing from my hands to hers. It was nice to be useful, even in the smallest way. Nell's husband was a lawyer who worked long hours and had always wanted a kid, though Nell's drinking was making it hard for them to imagine having one. As Nell showed me around, she pointed out her old hiding spots for bottles, a paper bag under the kitchen sink behind the cleaning supplies, an old camping bag in the garage where she'd rolled them in blankets. I remembered listening for Dave's key in the lock, drinking the last of the gin, brushing my teeth so hard my gums bled. That night we played charades. We played it hard. We played apples to apples. We drew trustworthy and someone put down Canadians, then someone won with whiskey, a wild card that had been added, handwritten. We drew desperate and I wanted to put down board games. We poured our Diet Coke from liter bottles. Middle-aged women in pastel cardigan sweaters talked about shooting heroin into parts of the body I didn't know it could be shot into. We talked about how to get through a day without the old horizons of relief, and there was relief in that, in hearing another human being say how fucking hard it was, for her as well, just the simple act of living in the world without anything to blunt its edges. The longer I spent in Nell's house, the more amazing she seemed to me, just getting up each day in a home full of the ghosts of her old hidden bottles, facing up to the husband she'd disappointed, trying to own the pieces of her life again, trying to do, as I was hearing people say in meetings, the next right thing. Driving home, I imagined me and all these women getting drunk together in a bar somewhere, totally sloppy, doing the one thing that connected all of us, but that we'd never do together. I wanted to meet the people these women had been when they were drunk. The din and revelry of that impossible night was like noise from another room, something muffled behind a door. I recognized whatever remained in Nell that made her want to point out exactly where the bottles had been. Under there, up there, tucked in there. I imagined her back in her empty house, in its dark subdivision, sweeping up pastry crumbs, wiping down surfaces that were already clean, fighting the swallowing quiet. One part of me was sorry that she couldn't just grab a vodka bottle from the camping backpack and sink into that sweet, clean stupor. But another part of me believed in this aftermath, its daily accumulations. "Don't leave before the miracle happens," another woman told me, and I thought, sure, okay, but also wanted to know when. I wanted to know the exact date of the miracle, day, month, and year, for me and for Nell, so I could tell her, just hold out till then. At least there was this. When Dave and I sat down to eat our corn and tomato salads, I was no longer trying to hide the wild animal of need, no longer trying to keep from saying, let's drink another round. Can we pour another glass? Now we drank sparkling water with lime. As a sobriety gift, Dave gave me an antique seltzer carbonator, a beautiful glass and wire contraption that could make soda from syrup, raspberry, ginger, vanilla. I loved him so much for that gift, for the way he was brightening the landscape of the great dry forever of sobriety. We just had to get a little cartridge to carbonate the water. We were trying to launch ourselves back into the wonder of our relationship in its early months. On a bright, cold winter day, we drove in search of a place called the Maharishi Vedic City, a town founded by a guru in the middle of cornfields, where every building faced east and had a golden spire on its roof. It even had its own currency, the Ram. Its transcendental meditation halls were called yogic flying chambers. I'd seen online videos of yogic flying, people bouncing across mats with their knees crossed. It looked awkward, but joyful, and I wanted to believe that the flurry of their effort was a sign of transcendence rather than its absence. Dave and I drove through snowy cornfields and kept our eyes peeled for golden spires. What we found was a desolate dirt road, patchy with unplowed snow, and a building the color of sour cream where vegan brunch was being served, lentils and curried cauliflower, though Dave wasn't even hungry since he'd eaten so much jerky on the road. But he ate anyway, because we were doing this together. He pointed out a small red fox trotting gracefully across the crusted snow, leaving a trail of delicate prints in its wake. We had no ROM, but it turned out we could pay with a credit card. After brunch, full of lentils, we went looking for the yogic flying chambers. We nearly ran our car into several snowdrifts. We were trying so hard to have a good day. When we found the flying chambers, they were empty. We stood at the threshold and peered inside, where meditating bodies should have been, their knees flapping like bird wings. There was only silence, and a stillness so solitary it made me want to touch the man next to me, Fox Spotter, co-pilot. And so I did. I touched him, and then we left. Loving Dave was like this. It was his jeans against my tights when we kissed in our kitchen, my hands still soapy from the dishes, and the tornado siren wailing outside. It was eggs and coffee on our orange couch, with mounds of snow outside our windows, domed over the cars, in drifts like hills over the park, as we shivered with gratitude for our home, this living room, this warmth. It was the way we delivered the world to each other, how he told me about cedar waxwings landing just down the block from our house, in the middle of their migration, their breasts yellow like yolks stirred into milk, their little crested tufts like arrowheads. Loving Dave meant going to Gabe's, a club downtown that smelled like stale beer and other people's sweat, and watching a woman layer drum loops with her ukulele, listening to her alto voice full of gristle and yearning, sensing the hum of Dave's excitement beside me, as this woman captured her chorus with her foot pedal and played it back with a difference. How excited he was by the sheer act of making. It meant hearing a teenage girl in the library talking to her friend. When Brian and I were going out and he would wall me like, I like you so much, I don't even have words. And knowing I had found one with all the words, but I still felt walled. Loving him meant getting thrown onto our bed and tickled, our fierce play, and then lying in bed for hours the next night, waiting for him to come home, picking his dark curls off the pillows to remind myself he slept here. This was our bed. It smelled like the smell that lived in the crook of his neck. Dave taught me a quote from Gertrude Stein, "Dirt is clean when there is a volume." And I wanted this to mean there was something on the other side of all our accumulated friction, how we clashed against each other and then came back to say, "It's you I want." When I watched him sleep, with one arm flung across his face, love ached through me so hard I had to ball the sheets in my fist. As an exercise in surrendering control, Dave asked his students to write collaborative poems. "When this happens," he wrote once, describing the assignment, "you can feel the boundary between self and other flicker, each an organ to some larger being." He gave me a poem he'd written about a flock of birds lifting off from the park across the street, as if touching the same being made them part of the same dream. Though I saw us living in binary, Dave wanted to be free, and I wanted to be certain. In truth, we were asking so many of the same questions. What it meant to let your edges dissolve, to be surprised, to touch some dream or being larger than yourself. Charles Jackson's wife, Rhoda, who arguably had even greater reason to celebrate Jackson's recovery than Jackson himself, wrote gratefully about the camaraderie he found in AA. "It's all so easy and natural and no posing or anything. Everyone likes Charlie, but it's all on an even footing and he responds to that very happily. He has no resentment of the fact that he really couldn't meet many of the members on any other terms, that they're not very bright or interesting or anything." Rhoda acknowledged that her husband's fellowship in recovery didn't glitter like his literary company, but she still celebrated what it was giving him. Even footing, naturalness, ease. Jackson worried that people might think he'd gotten boring in recovery. He was anxious it would leave him lusterless, make him terrible company at cocktail parties, replace his electric charms with what he later called vegetable health. In an aside to a friend, when writing about how much he'd come to love AA, he added an anxious addendum, "Please don't squirm at this." But Jackson also loved the way he'd been embraced by AA. Going to a meeting with him, one friend observed, was like visiting a birth control clinic in the company of Margaret Sanger. As Blake Bailey, his biographer, has observed, part of the zenith of Jackson's AA involvement, the second half of the 1950s, was also an artistic dry spell for him. The church basements of AA gave Jackson affirmation as a storyteller during years when he was creatively blocked. Jackson loved showing up late somewhere and telling friends that he'd been speaking at a meeting and the members simply wouldn't let him go. He loved being the expert and the star pupil at once. It was his new addiction. He loved going out with AA folks for ice cream. But loving this admiration didn't preclude being drawn to recovery for other reasons, for the sense of connection and leveling Rhoda described. People are nothing if not multiple vectors of desire, drawn to behaviors and communities for a thousand reasons at once. Jackson was certainly aware of his own hunger for affirmation and how it was part of the fabric of his AA life, even though it worked against the AA ethos of humility. But when he spoke in meetings, he confessed these ulterior motivations rather than trying to deny them. Yes, he wanted to be an AA star, but he also wanted AA to give him a way to get outside himself. Both yearnings were authentic. AA fueled his ego and it offered him relief from his ego's tyrannical engine. It was certainly true that the success of The Lost Weekend was part of why Jackson found himself so beloved in the rooms. Even though the novel wasn't a celebration or validation of recovery, it was still a clear-eyed portrait of the disease. As Bill Wilson wrote to Jackson in 1961, "My dear Charlie, thanks for your thoughtfulness in sending me the new edition of The Lost Weekend. To have an autographed copy from you is to have a very real keepsake, a remembrance also of your demonstration in the later years of all that is AA. Please be assured of my constant affection and friendship. Always devotedly, Bill." Wilson's letter gently acknowledged that Jackson hadn't always been an AA fan. But after he got deeply involved in the early 50s, Jackson was eager to share his enthusiasm publicly. Just 5 months after his stay at the Saul Clinic, in December 1953, Jackson landed a commission with Life to write a two-part article about AA. Part one, the story of his disastrous drinking, came easily. Part two, called Possible Answers, proved more difficult. Jackson tried to explain the philosophy and practice of AA, but his editor found the piece disappointing and wanted Jackson to dramatize more, the very thing that Jackson would later chastise himself for doing too much in his early AA spiels. For Life, the story of a drunken train wreck was more interesting than the story of its redemption, and the piece never ran. Its aborted trajectory was an early manifestation of the creative dilemma that would haunt Jackson for the rest of his career. Would he ever be able to tell another story as well as he'd told the story of falling apart? During my early months, recovery did not seem like a compelling story. It was like moving through water rather than air. Effort saturated everything. "I know what will happen if I drink," another sober alcoholic said. "I don't know what will happen if I don't." This was a promise I desperately needed the world to make good on. I was trying so hard to find something wonderful in the world that I hadn't seen before, to make the sobriety worth it. At the Art Institute in Chicago, willing myself toward beauty, I looked for it in the Chagall windows, all those bunchy bodies curved upward into flight, and the Giacometti statues, so thin they'd disappear if you squinted. I clutched at everything, not really caring about anything. I cared about drinking and how I wasn't doing it. "Look at those flakes of sunlight," I wrote about some painting, "falling from wrong-colored suns." At the bakery, I was often distracted, forgetting about cookies in the oven while I was pulling espresso shots in the front of the house. We had to dump trays of burnt snowflakes in the trash, parchment paper and all. I was easily rattled by almost everything. Just before Thanksgiving, I'd handed a woman her order, 40 gingerbread turkeys, and she had a meltdown right there at the counter. They were supposed to be sugar cookies, she said, asking, "What am I supposed to do with these?" And then I had a meltdown of my own, sputtering sorry after sorry, and it seemed like there wasn't a good answer to our situation. Her anger and my hopeless apologies, my frantic attempt to figure out if I'd been the one who'd gotten the order wrong or if someone else had gotten the order wrong, and I was desperately trying to determine if her emotions were valid or my emotions were valid. I wanted to slap her or prostrate myself in front of her. It was like the apocalypse. And then my boss came out of the kitchen and told the woman we'd get her 40 sugar cookie turkeys in a couple of hours. I thought, oh, that was another way of responding to a moment. Every time I imagined getting home and having a glass of wine, I remembered that I couldn't. Already it was starting. The nostalgia. Drinking had been the honeyed twilight sun falling over every late afternoon, softening everything to amber. In December, my oldest brother was planning to run a 100-kilometer race called Hellgate. It was supposed to start at midnight in Virginia, and I decided to run with him, not in Virginia, but in Iowa, timing my run to align with his start. It would be an act of solidarity. I imagined my new life in sobriety as something that might seem zany and inspired. "Oh, I used to get drunk every night, but now you never know what I'm going to do. I might go for a nighttime run in the Arctic cold." I was convinced that if I did things I wouldn't have done before I got sober, then sobriety would be worth it. Jamie, my boss at the bakery, told me she'd put out a thermos of hot cocoa in her backyard for me. I bundled up. Long underwear, sweatpants, wind pants, a sweatshirt, and a ski jacket. Dave had some friends over, and I told them what I was doing, and they were like, okay. But I could see they were a little confused. In my mind, they were trying to figure out whether this plan had anything to do with my sobriety. But in truth, they probably didn't even realize I'd stopped drinking or didn't really care, because most people weren't obsessed with drinking or not drinking the way I was obsessed with both. When I started jogging, that swelling music I'd been imagining as soundtrack didn't start. My nose was so cold it went numb almost instantly. I was aware of myself as someone you might cross the street to get away from. It was 11 at night, and I was running through the cold in layers, track pants swishing with every step, fingers going numb under my gloves, thinking, this is great, right? This is really something, right? When I reached the thermos in my boss's backyard, 2 miles later, I took a sip and realized the cocoa had booze in it. I spit it out onto the snow. When I met other alcoholics for coffee or sugary pastries, the vices still available to us, I began to spend those dates imagining how the drinking might work a little better than it had before. Reading the big book with another woman over night discounted muffins, I was secretly concocting a plan. If I drank again, I'd only drink 3 nights a week. The restriction would make me look functional to Dave, and hopefully keep my tolerance low enough that I'd be able to get just the right buzz from only 3 drinks. Maybe sometimes I'd need 4. And maybe the buzz could stay perched right there, at just the right level. And those other 4 nights would be great nights, sober nights, great sober nights. And on those great sober nights, I would of course have the non-sober nights to look forward to. If other people wondered about my drinking, I could just point at my non-drinking nights, how not big a deal they were, how much I enjoyed them. It seemed like this plan could work. It actually seemed pretty straightforward. That's when we hit the beginning of the big book's next chapter. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. Yes, that. Check. It wasn't just the big book that made me feel seen through and chord struck. When a sober friend, Emily, sent me a Carver poem about drinking called Luck, I saw myself reflected in the speaker, a 9-year-old boy wandering through an empty house full of half-drunk drinks on the morning after one of his parents' parties. The boy drinks a leftover lukewarm whiskey, then another. It's unexpected mana. All this booze and no one around to keep him from drinking it. What luck, I thought. Years later, I still wanted to give up friends, love, starry skies, for a house where no one was home, no one coming back, and all I could drink. Those lines spoke to the coiled longing at my core, the desire to disappear into the velvet depths of a solitary drunk with no one around to stop me. The poem said it so simply, without pretense or explanation, just, of course, that thirst. It made me think of Bug getting his vodka delivered. I'd never gotten that bad. Part of me still wanted to. Bill Wilson recognized that every sober alcoholic might reach a stage in her sobriety when she wanted to start drinking again. Alcoholics get to a point in the program where they need a spiritual experience, he told Betty Eisner, a psychologist, but not all of them are able to have one. This was 20 years into Wilson's own sobriety, and with Eisner's help, he had just taken his first acid trip on August 29th, 1956, at the VA hospital in Los Angeles, an experiment that was part of his broader exploration into the various ways LSD might be useful in recovery. Describing that first trip to a friend, Wilson compared it to his early visions of AA as a chain of drunks around the world, all helping each other. For Wilson, acid summoned visions of collectivity and possibility, dissolving his boundaries and connecting him to forces beyond himself. He experienced his first acid trip as a dead ringer for the spiritual experience he'd had at New York's Towns Hospital 2 decades earlier. the mountaintop vision that catalyzed his recovery. Because acid had helped him eliminate many barriers erected by the self or ego that stand in the way of one's direct experiences of the cosmos and of God, Wilson imagined it might do this for others, especially cynical alcoholics who hadn't had visions of their own. The rest of AA didn't exactly embrace Wilson's exploration of hallucinogens. As his official AA biography puts it, most AAs were violently opposed to his experimenting with a mind-altering substance. But Wilson's fascination with acid was an organic extension of his commitment to one of the core principles of AA recovery, the elimination of the ego, that barrier between a self and everything beyond it. Around that time, Wilson found another way around the ego through a spiritualist practice called automatic writing. During these spook sessions, Wilson believed he was taking dictation from visiting spirits, effectively allowed to inhabit his own voice and escape it at once. Automatic writing let the reluctant number one man become an ordinary vessel, or at least a more passive one, a listener. In a 1952 letter to Ed Dowling, a priest who would eventually join the informal acid-dropping salon Wilson organized in New York, Wilson describes getting help from spirits in writing 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, his extended practical outline to the AA program. "One turned up the other day calling himself Boniface," he wrote, "a man of learning who knew a lot about structures. AA was nothing if not a structure, and Wilson granting credit to Boniface was the humbling logic of recovery writ large, across the astral plane, crediting the voices of others rather than his own." Wilson also said that Boniface checked out pretty well in the encyclopedia. Wilson liked the notion that the wisdom wasn't coming from his own mind. It fit with the ethos of interdependence that was central to his understanding of recovery. "I have good help. Of that I am certain," he told Dowling, "both over here and over there." Records of this help remain in the AA aphorisms scribbled all over scraps of paper left in the wake of Wilson's spook sessions. "First things first. God grant me the serenity. Take it easy." In automatic writing, Wilson found a cousin to the surrender of the first step. Each session involved the logic of a blackout transplanted to sobriety, letting his body become the vessel for an agency he couldn't claim. It was a desire directed toward otherness, not the other voices in a meeting, but voices even farther out, voices beyond the room entirely. One of the longest fragments still remains on the back of page 164 of a big book typescript. "Are you going to stop smoking? Please do, Bill, as you are being prepared as a channel for important things. You must believe us when we say that you are destined for tremendous development. Please, please, Bill, do this and do not fail us. So much more depends upon your attitude and actions. You are a link in a long chain, and you must not be the weakest point. Do not fear contact by us. Go and lie down, but please don't smoke anymore." Wilson was a lifelong smoker. He kept it up in sobriety with even greater fervor. And there was a tragic earnestness lodged in this moment of ventriloquized self-awareness. Wilson's own survival impulse announced itself from a celestial distance. He listened to a voice trying to persuade him to stop smoking, a voice he tried to convince himself belonged to someone else. Wilson's spook sessions and his acid trips and his nicotine addiction aren't the parts of his story that sit most comfortably inside his legend. But for me, they don't undermine the story of his sobriety, they humanize it. They speak to the raggedness of his recovery, or anyone's, the ways it might always yearn for something more. "You are destined for tremendous development. Are you going to stop smoking?" He didn't, and died of emphysema at the age of 75. Wilson tried to project authority elsewhere, in these astral voices, but eventually came back to an assertion of his own singularity. "You are destined." It was one of the peculiar paradoxes embedded in his sobriety, which ultimately wasn't like everyone else's, no matter how much he wanted it to be. In February 1957, The General Service headquarters of AA released a pattern script for radio and television appearances. It provided a script for any AA John to follow, stressing that he should limit himself to general points about alcoholism and fellowship, including only a brief personal interlude. Suggested that at this point, John speak extemporaneously about 2 minutes, qualifying himself as an alcoholic, as he might do at an AA open meeting. Further suggested that, to minimize rambling, comments hew closely to theme of how alcoholics hurt others while drinking. At one point, the script even prompted John to say, "Naturally, I can speak only for myself," even though John was following a script, one that was supposed to translate his story into something that could apply to every drunk who might be listening. When I first saw the pattern script, it seemed to crystallize everything that was troubling about recovery narratives, their cookie-cutter conventions, and the tyranny of their triptych structure. What it was like, you're drinking. What happened, why you stopped. What it's like now, your sobriety. The flip side of resonance in meetings was the suspicion that this resonance was simply self-fulfilling prophecy, that we convinced ourselves our stories were all the same and then pressured one another to tell them the same way. Perhaps our platitudes were just sheepdogs herding us into neat clusters of oversimplified dysfunction. We were all selfish in the same simple ways, fearful in the same simple ways, escaping our own lives in the same simple ways. Clichés were one of the hardest parts of my early days in recovery. I cringed at their sing-song cadences. Meeting makers make it. It's the first drink that gets you drunk. Take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth. At meetings, I hated when other people abandoned narrative particularity in their stories. I accidentally crushed my daughter's pet turtle after too much absinthe for the bland pudding of abstraction. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I wanted crushed turtles and absinthe. Clichés were like blights, refusals of clarity and nuance, and insistence on soft-focus greeting card wisdom. This too shall pass, which I once saw on a cross stitch in the bathroom of a Wyoming meeting, followed by, "It just did." Long ago, I had learned that to become a writer, I had to resist clichés at all costs. It was such accepted dogma that I'd never wondered why it was true. "Keep it simple" was one of the clichés I struggled with most. I'd never thought there was anything simple about me or anyone else. Simplicity seemed like disrespect, a willful evasion of the wrinkles in every human psyche, a failure to witness consciousness fully. If life wasn't simple in the first place, how could you keep it that way? The insistence on simplicity seemed like part of AA's larger insistence that we were all the same, which was basically a way of saying fuck you to my entire value system. My whole life I'd been taught that something was good because it was original, that singularity was the driving engine of value. "Make it new," the modernist had said. It was impossible to imagine what it was to be, as a person or a story, without thinking in terms of difference. I'd always understood love in terms of singularity as well, an assumption I'd held so close it had become nearly transparent. I'm loved because I'm not quite like anyone else. Whenever someone talked about the unconditional love in the rooms of recovery, I always wanted to shout, "You can't love me. You don't even know me." Actually, when it came to love, I had somewhat contradictory desires. I wanted to be loved unconditionally, simply because I was, but I also wanted to be loved for my qualities. Because I was X. Because I was Y. I wanted to be loved because I deserved it. Except I was scared to be loved like this, because what if I stopped deserving it? Unconditional love was insulting, but conditional love was terrifying. This was something Dave and I had talked about, being loved for qualities or else without conditions. He taught me the notion of love bestowed shtam, as they said in Hebrew, for no earthly reason, because. Dave and I weren't fighting drunk anymore, but we were fighting sober, which was even worse, because I no longer had drinking as an alibi or an excuse. Without booze in the room to take the blame, these fights were between us, or between him and the brittle, vigilant version of myself I'd become. Honestly, I'd already been this person, but without drinking, I had no way to mute